stuffy right now. So if I strange, like if I start doing like strange things and all that kind of stuff, that's okay. Don't worry. I'm just, you know, not, I haven't slept. That's what I mean. Sorry, that's hard. And you know, it's going to be hard, but I'll do my best. So what I want to talk about today is this topological recursion that was already mentioned this morning of Hénard and Laurentin, which many of you have probably heard about it before. So but I'll have to review the whole recursion. So if you're bored, then well, just keep with me for that part. So I have to review the recursion, but I want to give you some applications of it. So that recursion kind of came out of very restricted areas of mathematics or mathematical physics, which was a random matrix theory. But now it turns out that it basically has plenty of applications in a lot of different areas, basically involving, well, pretty much everything that involves moduli space of Riemann surfaces seem to have the recursion popping out somewhere. So it seems that this kind of recursion is very, well, has some nice properties, and it just appears everywhere. So there's something, there's some nice structure there that needs to be understood. And in particular, the areas I want to focus on today is going to be about Hurwitz theory and Grimbergen theory, so topological string theory. And in these cases, we had some conjectures, and now parts of them are proved. And I'm going to talk about, like, at least kind of like general steps that, well, should lead to a proof, but the complete proof is a work in process, so there's still some calculations that haven't been done. So there is no complete proof of this kind of conjectures yet, but I'm going to come to that. But anyway, there's a lot of like new applications, and I want to emphasize in the end some generalizations which link to a newer results in topological string theory and instanton counting and all of that. So there's plenty of really exciting things related to that recursion, so I hope I'm going to transmit this excitation to you. So let me start by something very simple, because it's nice to start with something simple, so at least you understand the beginning and you can say that you got something of this talk. So I'm going to start with the simplest recursion maybe that you can think of, just to give you an example of what a recursion looks like. So you all know what Fibonacci numbers are, right? So how do you define a recursion? Well, you first need to define what you're actually talking about, so some objects. So in this case, what you want to talk about some numbers, and these are indexed by an integer, n. Which say you can take to be greater or equal to zero. So that's the first thing. Then if you want to define your recursion, you first need some initial conditions. In the case of these numbers, well, you fix F0 to be zero, F1 to be one. And then the next step to define the recursion is that you need a recursion, right? So that's the next thing, which is the recursion law or recurrence law or whatever, which in this case is just given by this beautiful equation. So that's very simple. So that's a recursion. That's great. So now what I'm going to talk about is another recursion, and then I'm going to talk about that, obviously. And the recursion I'm going to talk about is going to be much more complicated. So that was the easy part. Now it's going to be the more complicated part. So what I want to define is a similar recursion, but I want to define different objects, different initial conditions, and different recursion law. So the only thing that is similar is the word recursion. So how do I actually define my recursion? Well, okay, so let's start by defining the object. So what do I actually want to talk about? Huh, you want me to use that one? Okay. Is that better? Okay. So what kind of objects do I want to talk about? So here it was just numbers. That was great. Now I want to talk about multilinear differential forms. Huh. Much, much more fun. So I actually want to talk about some objects, which I'm going to index with two integers. So let me write them WGNs. I'm going to depend on n variables. And I take g to be an integer, n to be an integer, g to be greater or equal to 0, n to be greater or equal to 1. So there's at least one variable here. And now these objects are going to be multilinear differential forms living on some curve, which I haven't specified yet. So I'm going to specify in a second. So some complex curve. So by multilinear differential forms, what I mean is this. This is a symmetric product of meromorphic one forms on the product of n curves, if you wish. Or in other words, the symmetric differential forms in n argument scale. Okay, so these are the objects I want to define recursively. Now, what do I mean by recursion here? There's two integers, so it's not a recursion in both integers. And in fact, it's called a topological recursion for a particular reason, is that it's topological. So to know, to theta is topological, I'm going to associate to each of these objects a Riemann surface. So in this case, G is going to be the genus, and N is going to be the number of holes. So this is a genus G with N holes Riemann surface. So to each of these objects, I associate such an object. And now I define, as usual, the Euler characteristic, 2G minus 2 plus N. And in fact, the recursion is going to be on this Euler characteristic here. So that's why it's called topological recursion. So, and that's where the Riemann surface comes in. So that's why this kind of recursion is going to have plenty of applications everywhere that Riemann surfaces pop in, because basically to each of these objects, I can associate a Riemann surface, and the recursion is going to be based on some sort of decomposition of moduli space of Riemann surfaces.
Is it called the
Levy? I'm sorry?
Is it called the
Levy? Okay, but I actually mean, so what I mean is that, okay, maybe you can take minus if you want. But I mean that this is going to be positive, right? So I want to a recursion on this positive numbers. Okay, so now I need to fix the initial condition. So these are the objects I'm interested in. Next thing I need to fix the initial ones. So the lowest order one is when, okay, let me forget about this sign, because I don't want to have to carry some minus sign everywhere, but you can call it psi prime if you want. But the lowest order is going to be psi equals to minus 1. So that's genus 0 with one hole. And then, so this is a 0, 1 object that I need to fix. And the other initial condition I need to fix is the 0, 1, these two objects. So in terms of Riemann surfaces, this is a disk. This is just the cylinder, two holes, and genus 0. Now I have to fix these two objects. How do I do that? So I haven't told you what the curve is. So this is exactly what this first object is going to tell me. So this is called a disk amplitude because it's a disk. And if I define, so let me write it in this way. So this is a meromorphic one form. Y is some meromorphic functions. And in fact, now I take the Riemann surface defined by Y, and that defines the spectral curve C. So Riemann surface C, I'm going to call the spectral curve. And this is going to be the curve that where all of these meromorphic differentials are going to live. So the curve that I'm interested in is actually defined by the disk amplitude here. So I'm not telling you what these objects are. So now I'm just giving you the kind of structure of the recursion, and then I'll tell you in the specific problems what these things are. But the point here is that the disk amplitude defines a surface. Let me just give you an example. For example, if you had something like that. Yeah, here I didn't fix the C, so I'm actually fixing it right here as being the Riemann surface on which the disk amplitude lives. So for example, if you had this, it's just going to be a case, for example, in the very simple matrix models. If you get that, then the Riemann surface is going to be defined by this equation in C squared. That's the simplest example you could think of, maybe. But you can have here any kind of functions here. It doesn't have to be given by some algebraic. The curve here doesn't have to be given by some algebraic equation. It can be given by any curve, basically. So any complex curve. Okay, now I need to define the second initial condition of the recursion. So I need to define this object. Now to define that, let me remind you of a bit of a complex analysis, something called the Cauchy kernel. So in two variables, for example, you can define this object such that if I take the residue of this Cauchy kernel times any function of z, then I get the differential. That's just a kind of standard kernel you can use in complex analysis. Did I do it right? Yeah. Now, what I want to do is there's a generalization of that, which is actually valid for any Riemann surface and not just on the plane, not just on the complex plane. It's called Bergmann kernel. So let me write it B, Z, and W as defined in exactly the same way. So you apply it on any function, and you get the differential of that function, but that's actually valid for any Riemann surface and not just living on a complex plane. So if the Riemann surface here, where you're actually taking the residue, is genus 0, then the Bergmann kernel is just a Cauchy kernel. But for higher genus Riemann surface, it's going to be some more complicated expression. It can be completely characterized by the fact that it has a double pole, like here, with no residue. But for a general Riemann surface, it's going to have some regular terms here if you do an expansion. So it's not just going to be this thing. But anyway, it's uniquely defined up to normalization. You have to normalize it on the basis of A and B cycles, which is not going to be relevant for us. But this is an object which is uniquely defined if I give you any curve. And in fact, this is going to define my initial condition here. I'm going to take this object to be the Bergmann kernel of my spectral curve C, which I define to be the disk amplitude. Now again, as I say, that seems to come out of nowhere, and I'm just giving you the structure of the recursion, and I explain afterwards why this works and why this is interesting by giving you plenty of examples where it computes interesting things. But right now, I'm just giving you the structure. So now you know the objects, you know the initial conditions. Well, I have to give you the recursion. So how do I define the recursion? So now it has to be, it's a little bit more complicated, but not really. It's the same kind of idea of taking residue with the kernel in front, but that instead of being a function, it's going to be some complicated combination of the W's, and it's going to be recursively defined in this way. So what I need to first consider, so the interesting thing that you need to consider is the X projection of your curve. So the curve here, you can define it in two variables, x and y, can project on the x-axis. So you're basically projecting on the x-axis. If you look at this projection, I'm going to assume that there's only simple branch points of this projection, which I'm going to call alpha. In fact, you can define the whole recursion without assuming that, but the formula are more complicated. So I'll assume that for the sake of having nicer formula. And now I can write down the recursion. So let me write it down, and then I'll explain the notation. So you take residue, some variable C. Now you take residue at the branch points. So you take your curve, look at the projection, you take residue at the branch point. You have a kernel here, which is kind of the Bergmann kernel, but it's something more complicated, which I will define in a second. And then you have the recursive terms. And then okay, so now let me explain the notation. This is I'll give you in a second a pictorial representation, and you'll see that this is just a kind of decomposition of the moduli space of Riemann surfaces. So that makes sense. Well, you can already see it, I guess, if you interpret G as a genus, and these are poles, you can see the kind of decomposition we're doing. But the notation here is as follows. So S here is just indexing 1 to n, so this goes from 1 to n, so you have n plus 1 variables here. Here I'm just splitting into in all possible ways of splitting the n variables here. Z and z hat parameterize the two branches near a branch point alpha. So in other words, near alpha I have the same x projection for both z and z hat. So these give you the two branches if you have a branch point. These parameterize the two branches here. ZNC hat. And since I assume they're simple, that's why I want to assume it's simple so I can write it in terms of these two nice variables. And the other thing I need to define here is the kernel, which is defined as follows. So I'm integrating the Bergmann kernel over Z prime. Then I'm dividing by this funky thing. So what I mean by dividing by differential is just that when it acts on the dx, it just cancels out. So it's just if you want some sort of vector, if you wish. But it's got a pairing with the differential here. But so this is the kernel you want to integrate against, so take the residue against to get this recursive formula here. Sorry, that's z hat here. Where is the z bar? Oh, there should be c. Okay. So that defines a recursion. Where does it come from to start with? Because now I've just defined the structure without giving you any hint whatsoever where it comes from. So the story is that it comes from the matrix model. So if you have a matrix integral, well, you can do a large N expansion when N is the dimension of your matrix. And then you can basically, you have a set of differential equations, which are called loop equations, just corresponding to saying that the basically, well, they correspond to many different things, Virasoro constraint, or saying that the integral is invariant under reparametrization, or can see them in plenty of ways, but it's a set of differential equations that you can solve, and you end up with precisely that recursion. So this is the recursion that computes all the possible correlator in your matrix integral, order by order in the Lagrangian expansion, which is indexed by G. So that doesn't come out of nowhere. That comes out of matrix models. But what I want to claim, or what I want to emphasize in this talk, is that it actually has plenty of applications without talking about matrix models at all. So I will give you examples in a second. Now, let me just write down some pictorial representation of what's going on so that you see what kind of the composition of Riemann surfaces this recursion comes from. So suppose that I'm going to do a simple example. So suppose that I do the genus 1 with two hole, and I want to compute it from the right-hand side. So this is basically something like that. So if I want to decompose the moduli space of Riemann surface to get the right-hand side, so you could think that you're doing just a standard pair of fans decomposition, as people always do when they talk about moduli space of Riemann surfaces, but it's slightly more subtle. I mean, you could rewrite the recursion as a recursion in terms of pair of fans, but that would be different, and it wouldn't be as nice. You would have extra terms and things like that. So the actual decomposition you have to do goes as follows. So you first have to choose one of the boundary. This is the one corresponding to Z0 here. So this is a kind of choice that you do. You choose one of the boundary. Then you kind of move inside as if you were doing circles up to where you hit a kind of point where it becomes a figure 8 instead of being a circle, because now it kind of moves around. So now when you hit that, then you can decompose your Riemann surface. You get something like that. And this gives you precisely the second term here, where you have annulus and genus 1, 1 whole. And this thing, kind of weird thing here, is the kernel K here. You can actually compute it. If you really make sense of that in much more rigorously, you can see where this formula comes from when you compute these things here. But that's the kind of pictorial representation for the second term. To get the first term, you just take the same thing. But now you take the case where the genus is here. So when you start here, you move here, get the figure 8 here, so you end up with something like that. Well, you get three hole here. And that, again, is the kernel, and that gives you the one genus less and one hole more. So what I was saying when I said it's not really a pair of fans, you see that this is a cylinder, so it wouldn't be there if the pair of fans was the fundamental object. But you could reformulate everything in terms of pair of fans if you wanted, just would give extra terms here. In other words, you would have extra terms for the unstable contribution to this recursion. But this is the kind of decomposition you're talking about when you write this recursion. Does that make any sense? Yep. Okay. So that's the recursion. Now the main question is, well, why is that interesting? And what I'll let you decide if it's interesting or not. I think it is. But let me rephrase it in a more easier to answer question. So what is it actually computing? So what are these objects that I'm computing here? So I give you this amplitude, so a 0-1 object. I give you the initial condition. Actually, I only need to give you this one, which defines a spectral curve. Then 0-2 is given in terms of the Bergmann kernel, compute everything else. But what is it actually computing? So, well, there's two ways you could approach this question. You could try to answer it directly, right? Given any spectral curve, try to construct some moduli space, which clearly involves Riemann surfaces, and try to see what kind of invariance of the moduli space you're actually computing. And, well, this is a very interesting question. It hasn't been solved, and I think some people are working on that, actually, probably. I think some people in Megia are working on that. I'm not sure. But that's a very interesting question, but I don't have much to say. What I'm going to say is more take specific examples where I know there's some Riemann surface in play, and then I'm going to give you a specific curve that comes from the disk amplitude and show you that everything that I compute here really compute the invariance that you're interested in for that particular question. The simplest example is the one we heard this morning. Okay, so to get some interpretation of those, clearly you want some Riemann surfaces. First thing you can look at is intersection theory on moduli spaces of Riemann surfaces, as we heard this morning. So this comes to Witten's conjecture, Concevich matrix model, all this stuff. And in fact, what you will see in this case is that the kind of recursion seems to be kind of joining all the different approaches to that problem together. So it's kind of nice in this way. So what happens, as we heard this morning, there's two different kind of approach. There's one which was done by Concevich, where he basically wrote a matrix model. As I said, if you have a matrix model, you can extract a spectral curve, and all the correlators in your matrix model are going to be given by these recursion. And it turns out that all these correlators here are going to compute basically intersection of psi classes and also kappa classes when you have the WGNs. That was done by Concevich. Here, all we're saying is that this is just a reformulation of what Concevich found with his matrix model. But the recursion really computes these objects here. Now, there was another approach that we saw, which was, okay, where is the H? Is that after the zero? Is that good? Okay, so what Mirzakhani found is a completely different approach using hyperbolic geometry, but she also found a recursion that was satisfied by these intersection, by these integral over the moduli space of Riemann surfaces. So she also found a recursion here, but from a different, completely different point of view. And then we also heard that there was a kind of intermediate step, which was basically involving counting lattice points, and was also involving integral over moduli space of Riemann surfaces. Now, what happens if you really work by all this? I'm not going to do it for this case, but I'm going to do it for Hervis case and local mirror symmetry, because exactly the same structure appears. What happens is that all of these are related to the recursion in some way. So the recursion really appears here. To get from here to here, what you have to do is a Laplace transform. So you take, and we'll do how that works in the other examples, but it's exactly the same. In fact, Laplace transform goes the other way around. And to get from here to here, you also have a nice, sorry, let's get from here to here. What you're doing is basically expanding near branch points, the recursion, and all of those become the same. In other words, all these recursions are just the same. They just amount to finding a different expansion of the WGN to go from here to here, and then taking Laplace transform to go the other way around. And this is exactly what's going to happen in the mirror symmetric point of view. So in some way, you could say that this is kind of mirror. Because in local mirror symmetry, that's exactly the same kind of thing that's going to happen. This side is going to be the A model, Grimm-Witten theory. This side is going to be recursion or the B model. But you have exactly the same relation here with an intermediate, some sort of step here that we actually don't know what it means from the mirror symmetry point of view, which is would be very interesting to understand.
But doesn't that the word
Well, here there's no A model or B model. I'm just saying that the structure is the same. Oh, yeah, okay. So, yeah, what would the B model be? complex structure of a point. I'm sorry.
Why did you
call? Well, okay. I mean. I mean, I don't really. All I mean is that exactly the same kind of triangle of with the same steps appear in mirror symmetry. But here, there's no. I mean, it's not mirror. In Hurwitz's case, also you're going to get that, but there's no. It's not really mirror symmetry. But, okay. I mean. But it's interesting that exactly the same structure appears because it's a different kind of setup. Well, maybe there is something like the model, which is hidden there, which I don't know, but I don't have anything to say. Okay, so that was the case that was seen this morning. Now I want to talk about the two other cases, which are also involve Riemann surfaces, but in a slightly more complicated way. When did I actually start? 3:30? 3:15.
Good.
So, first case is the case of Hurwitz numbers. So we also heard about that this morning. So in fact, I'm also only going to talk about simple Hurwitz numbers, but it turns out that you can do a similar thing for multiple Hurwitz numbers. The recursion you get also, however, is different. You don't get the same recursion. So that's kind of interesting. It's actually simpler to look at double Hurwitz numbers than simple Hurwitz numbers. But that's still, I guess, I don't think that's been published yet. It's work by Einar, I think, but I'm not sure exactly. But the simple Hurwitz numbers case is well understood by now. So what is simple Hurwitz numbers? Well, we saw it this morning. So you look at covering of P1, which has only simple ramification point, simple ramification except at infinity. So at infinity, you have arbitrary ramification, which is indexed by a partition mu. Now you can define some invariants, hg mu, which are Hurwitz numbers, and they're basically counting these cover at genus g. So they're counting all the possible covers of by a Riemann surface of genus g with ramification given by the partition mu. Now these objects are really well understood. But it's a nice playground to understand these relations here. So let's see what happens. So the first thing you can do, as we always do, is we form generating functions. So I'm going to call them GN. And they're basically just some, okay, let me give you the expression, but it doesn't really matter. There's some combinatorial factor here, which is not very important. And then you use the basis of monomials. So you're looking at all permutations and the product over I index with some variable, I guess. And then, well, it's a differential form, so I have vx to vx. So anyway, the point here is just that, so this is the generating function for these objects. The basis here, so usually there's two bases you can take, usually to write this generating function, either in terms of monomials, like that here. I'm actually using exponential variables, just because it's going to be simpler later on, but it doesn't matter. But this is a basis of monomials. You could also use a basis of Newton polynomials, but just related by some simple combinatorics. And that's the one that appears in the recursion. Now, the claim, as you can tell, just by my notation, so the claim is that these WGNs here are actually computed by the recursion. So what this claim means is that if I take just the W01, that should define a curve, then the W02 should be given by the Bergman kernel of that curve, and all the higher WGNs should be computed by the recursion. Okay, so that was a conjecture. It's now been proved. In various ways. So let me, well, before I talk about the proof, let me give you what the curve is. So the first thing, so if you want to prove that, the first thing you need to check is the initial conditions. So the first thing you need to compute is the curve itself, so the disk amplitude, or the one-point amplitude here. In fact, in this case, it's pretty easy, because this is known. So in this case, the partition is length 1, so you're just summing over some integer. Here, have some n over genus 0, so you get basically 1 minus 1, n minus 1, plus, well, some basis here of monomial. I guess there's only one variable, px. A little sum here. So that's just the disk amplitude here. But this object here is being computed by Hurwitz a long time ago. This is just basically the covering of P1 by genus 0, so by P1 again, where your magnification is just given by a partition of length 1. So it's very easy to compute. It's actually equal to minus 3 or minus 2, depending on your normalization. I think here is minus 3. But in any case, the point is that now you can write the sum, get something like and that defines the curve. Now, it's easy to resum that and see that actually this defines a Riemann surface, which is, so if you let that be equal to y of x, this defines this Riemann surface here. And this has been called a Lambert curve because it's very close to the Lambert function. It's not exactly equal. There's some minus signs and things like that, but it's very close to the Lambert function. And this was kind of known already. This is not new. This was known that this kind of expression played a role, but it wasn't known that this was a spectral curve and that there was a recursion, that kind of stuff. So here it's really just resumming this thing. You can just expand that and see you get the same result. If I haven't made a mistake, maybe I've got the n wrong here. It depends on normalization, but yeah. Okay, so that's the first step, and this was easy to show for Hurwitz numbers because we have explicit expression for these Hurwitz numbers. Now, the second step is to compute the Bergman kernel. I'm not going to do it here because it's also simple. So the Bergman kernel, so this thing, you can write the expansion here. Now you get genus 0 Hurwitz numbers, but with partitions of length 2. Again, these are very well known from results of Hurwitz. So you can write the expression here, and you can show that this is precisely the Bergman kernel of this curve here. So this is really just a simple calculation. So this is true. But now the complicated step is to show that the recursion really works, so that not only the initial conditions are correct, but that the recursion really produces all these good WGM. How can you do that? Well, there's many ways you could try to do that. The two ways that have been successfully done, one is kind of not conceptually very interesting, but works, is basically just, well, it may be interesting in terms of integrability and things like that, but the idea is just to rewrite the partition function coming from these in terms of a matrix model. Now, in terms of matrix integral, if you have a matrix integral, then you can do the standard matrix model business, extract some large N expansion, extract the spectral curve, show that the spectral curve is really this one, and since this comes from the matrix model, then you've computed, you've shown that everything works. And this was done by Boho, who's a student of Enar, Enar Safnuk, and Munazi a little while back. But the second, well, there's two other ways you could try to prove that. A second way, which hasn't been done yet, but would be very interesting to do, and I think that's probably feasible, is to really look at the decomposition of the moduli space itself. So in this case, the moduli space, in terms of Hurwitz numbers, moduli space is very simple. It's just some Hurwitz space, basically becomes just a set of points. And now what you want to do is, you remember what I had here, the decomposition of these Riemann surfaces. You want to basically show that moduli space of these Hurwitz numbers kind of decompose into some fiber products where you have the different terms that I had in the recursion or in the decomposition that I had on the board. Now, if you can decompose the moduli space in this way, then you could decompose Hurwitz numbers, which are basically just kind of integrals over this moduli space. I'm being very schematic here because I haven't done it and hasn't been done. But I'm pretty sure that if you can decompose this thing here explicitly, that should work. That should give you the recursion. That's really what's going on. So that would be a direct geometric proof of that. And in this case, that probably works. But in the Rumoyton case, I don't think that's very That's a good way to think about it, because the modulized space is extremely more complicated for Gomotan theory, so I don't think you can do that explicitly. But that's another way that could be done to prove that, and it hasn't been done, but would be very interesting, I guess, to do it. Now, the third way, which has also been done by, I think, these four people again, is actually to use the cut-and-join equation. And this is the one which resembles the intersection number story. So let me now spend some time explaining how that works, because it's quite interesting. So there's different, so the WTNs here, okay, WGNs here, actually, so they have a nice interpretation when you expand here in terms of these parameters, right? So I just, let me just be schematic, and I can write that as basically some expansion when I have something like that. Roughly speaking, that's kind of the expansion I have here up to these combinatorial factors. And these objects here, the coefficients, are very interesting. They have a nice enumerative meaning. They give basically the Hurwitz numbers up to normalizations. So these are the interesting things you want to compute. So this is an expansion near x goes to infinity in these coordinates. But from the recursion point of view, these things here are not just expansions. They're actually like differential forms living on a curve. So you can kind of resum this expansion. This is just one expansion, but you can expand them anywhere. You can do whatever you want with those. And in fact, you really can do that explicitly because, well, the reason why you can, one reason why you can do it is that you know exactly, actually you can do more than that. You can rewrite these in terms of a finite sum, and then that gives you a way of actually expanding them in different places. And the reason you can do that is that you know exactly the pole behavior of those. From the recursion, you can compute exactly where the poles are, what the orders of these poles are, and these differential forms here have poles only at the branch points. So I call the branch points alpha, and they have a, the order is something like maximum 6g minus 6 plus 4, probably 4n, something like that. I'm not sure exactly what the number is. 6g minus 4 plus 2n. So this you can really compute just from the structure of the recursion. So you know that the objects you're computing only have poles there with this order. So you can write that, and you can now define a basis of one forms, of nomorphic one forms, with poles at the branch points of different orders. So let me call them omega k of z. And because of that structure here, you know that you can rewrite the WGNs at the finite sum in this basis. There's only a finite number of them which will contribute because of the maximum order of the pole here. So you can rewrite same object . So now I'm summing over k1 to kn, but there have to be less or equal than a certain value. I think it's 3g minus 3 plus whatever. But the point here, so you have some object here, and the expansion now is in terms of these k's. But this is a finite sum. This is really important, because what that means is that you've taken a, so if you only knew that, then there's no way you could expand somewhere else, right? You couldn't take an expansion and change it somewhere else. And then now you can rewrite it as a finite sum, and then you can expand it somewhere else. Now you probably don't know why I'm doing all that, but you'll see in a second that this is the way you can prove that this is really the recursion, that it really computes Hurwitz numbers. And in fact, this is really nothing else than ELSV formula. So we heard this morning about the ELSV formula, which was basically taking Hurwitz numbers, rewriting them as Hodge integrals. In fact, when you do that, that's exactly what you're doing. These are Hurwitz numbers. These are precisely the Hodge integrals. So this change of basis here from infinite sum, expansion at x equals to infinity, to the finite sum in this basis of differentials is really just the ELSV formula. So it's just a kind of nice way of seeing the ELSV formula appearing directly just from the structure of the differential forms. And we'll see that we have exactly the same thing for mirror symmetry or Gomotan theory. in general on toroid manifolds. Okay, now this is something you can do, and then you need to do the second step, third step, which is to expand near the branch points. So now you can take that. This is a finite sum, so now you can do another expansion. Let me write this. Okay, I'm again being very schematic, but now you're expanding in a coordinate which is valued near the branch points, call it z. So this is a good coordinate near the branch point, which are simple branch points. And these objects here, we have no idea what they mean. But there's some sort of new enumerative invariance, which in this case is pretty simple. They're just like, you could write them in terms of the Hurwitz number just with some combinatorial identities and kind of play with them. But generally, in Gomulton theory, we have no idea what these are. And these turn out to be the most fundamental object in the whole story. Because the point here, the point where I'm doing all that, is that this is the objects you can compare with the cut and join equation and the recursion. So you can really prove the whole story here in this way. So let me tell you how you prove that. So there's a set of equations that you know are satisfied by Hurwitz numbers. That, again, is very well known. There's cut and join equation. This is a set of, it's basically a differential equation which is satisfied by these generating functions here in terms of Hurwitz numbers. Now you can take that, transform the cut and join equations in terms of these coefficients, go to these coefficients, you end up with a recursion for these coefficients. And the recursion that you end up for the n is precisely the Laplace transform of the recursion that we started with, of that recursion. In fact, it's the inverse Laplace transform. So this one is the Laplace transform of this one. But so this is the way you can prove it, because otherwise there's no way you could kind of transform the cut and join equation and make like some residue come out of nowhere. But when you do this Laplace transform, the residue disappears. You end up with a standard recursion for these coefficients, which you can compare directly from what you would get from the cut and join equation. And it turns out that they're exactly the same. So there's exactly the same information contained in both. But the only way you can compare is to go through this kind of weird step of defining these invariants, which are, well, it's not clear what they mean. So let me rewrite the three steps that we did, and you see it has exactly the same structure as was the case for moduli space of curves. So you start on one side, you have cut and join equation. On the other side, you have topological recursion. Now you want to go to the step where you define these n's, which are kind of some weird invariants. To go from there to there, you do a Laplace transform. To go from there to there, you basically expand at the branch points. To do that, you really have to use the LSV formula. If you didn't have the LSV formula, you couldn't rewrite the expansion as a finite sum. There's no way you could do that. So this involves very fundamentally the fact that you can rewrite things in terms of finite sum of Hodge integrals. And then you can get through these things and prove that the two are the same. And again, I'm going to write that this is kind of mirror, because in the case of mirror symmetry, this is really mirror. So this is really the A model, and this is the B model. Okay, have I lost anyone? Everyone? Should I say? Not everyone. Good. So now I come to the interesting case, which is not proved yet, but should be proven exactly the same way. Well, some cases have been proved, but not the general case hasn't been proved yet. And that's the case of local mirror symmetry. Okay, so now I told you that this should apply to pretty much everywhere that Riemann surfaces pop out, and that's exactly what happens. So another case where you have Riemann surfaces is when you look at Gromoulton theory. So what is Gromoulton theory? So now instead of looking at moduli space of Riemann surfaces or covering of P1, you're actually looking at maps from Riemann surfaces to some target space, X, or stable maps. So now you want to, you basically want to define a moduli space of stable maps here. Actually, you want to compactify it. This is a crazy thing. It's all kind of weird. It's not really interesting. It's got all kinds of components of different dimensions. So you need to basically look at it virtually or define a virtual fundamental class. That's very complicated. But once you've done that, then you can integrate some sort of cohomology class in there, and you define the cohomology invariance in this way. So all these steps are quite complicated. And this is the reason that I'm saying that the idea of really decomposing the modulized space should work probably for Herbert's case. But in this case, I have no idea how to work with that modulized space, so that's probably kind of a hopeless approach, at least for now, at least for me, who doesn't know much about this crazy modulized space. But so it's probably nicer to look at this kind of approach. Okay, so that's how you define Gromovitian invariance. Now you can define what's called open Gromovitian invariance. So now you're looking at maps from Riemann surfaces with boundaries. So you have a target space again, but now you have a Lagrangian submanifold, and you require your boundaries to end on the Lagrangian submanifold here. In fact, in all I'm going to talk about, I'm going to require the target space to be a toric kind of U3-fold, because this is the only case that actually the recursion seems to work. Well, it's not the only case that it seems to work, but it's the only case that has been worked out. So you can, again, define some sort of modulized space of these things. This is very complicated. I don't think it's been defined. The way it's been defined mathematically is in what's called the mathematical theory of the topological vertex. And in fact, it's not defined in terms of Lagrangian submanifold, but in terms of relative stable maps. But in the end, the results are the same. When you calculate the invariance, they become the same. So this gives probably the rigorous mathematical definition of the modulized space you want to integrate against here to define your open Gromovitian invariance. So that was all done in the mathematical theory of the topological vertex. Now the statement, as you can guess, let me not erase that, is that I can construct some WGNs, which are generating functions of these open Gromovitian invariants. So I won't write down the explicit expression, but it's really just the same expansion as before. So you expand your variables here going to infinity, and then you have some coefficients here which you conjecture should be given by the open Gromovitian invariants. In fact, you also need here, you also have some Kähler parameters in general, so you also need to do some expansion in the Kähler parameters. So a few subtleties there, but this thing should, in principle, be the generating functions of open Gromovitian invariants. At least this is the conjecture. And it's been proved in a few cases, but not in general yet. So how can you prove that? Well, again, you just do the same thing as before. You need to prove that initial conditions work, then the recursion work. Now, the first thing you need to find is what the spectral curve should be in this case. So you want to compute the disk amplitude here. But it turns out that there's here a conjecture of, again, a Gickin-Wafa. So their conjecture is that this, if you write it as usual like that, defines a curve, which is called a mirror curve. It's gonna be actually polynomial and exponential variable here. And there's plenty of ways of getting this mirror curve without actually summing this disk amplitude. So this was defined by Hoge and Wafa and standard mirror symmetry, also by Chang, Clem, Yao, and Zaslow. So given the toric Kähler U3-fold, it's known that the mirror should be a curve, or at least all the geometry of the mirror should be encoded in a curve. And here, the conjecture of again, Gickin-Wafa is that the disk amplitude really gives you this curve. So that looks good. I mean, that looks exactly the kind of structure you want. Now, this is a conjecture. It has been proved by Jian Zhu for simple case. So for example, for the vertex, for simple toric geometries, this has been proved. The way it proves it is actually pretty brute force. So here you can actually compute this thing using the theory of the topological vertex, but you get some very complicated combinatorial a sum here over representation of something very complicated. Then he uses some kind of tricks with the Okunkov-Pandegi-Pandes operators to rewrite this in terms of a finite expression, and he managed to resum it and gets the curve in the end. But that takes like maybe 20 pages to do simple examples. So I don't think that's going to work. Well, it's hard to believe it's going to work in general. So there needs to be something else to prove that this is always true for any toric Kähler U3-fold. And in fact, in work in progress, we're trying to do that using what's called a quantum curve. which is the idea of replacing y by a quantum operator. And then this curve here becomes an operator, which you can, you know, basically can act on some function. And then the claim is that the function here should be the one-point function. If this is true, and it implies directly that the disk is the spectral curve, now you only need to show that this is, that this operator and the one-point function give zero. But in many cases, we can show it, but we cannot show it right now completely in full generality. This was proposed by Dijkgraaf and Wafa, and in fact, Agalagic, Marino, Dijkgraaf and Wafa, and Clem a little while ago, but it has never been shown in general that it should work. But anyway, that's probably one way of proving this conjecture. But okay, for now, we're going to assume that this is true. So this defines the spectral curve, which is in fact a mirror curve. Now you can try to show that this is the Bergman kernel of this curve. This hasn't been shown for basically, well, only for the vertex itself it has been shown. But for it, it hasn't been shown for any other geometries. I mean, what I mean by shown, I mean proved, because we can compute these as expansions, and we've shown that the expansion match. But to really prove it mathematically, it's very complicated because you end up with some infinite expansion that you need to resum, and that's not easy to do. So this, there's two ways you could try to prove that. Either use the approach that he does, that's going to become extremely complicated. The other way would be to try to define a kind of quantum version of the next step, which is the Bergman kernel. So you could define a quantum Bergman kernel and try to see if this is a solution of this quantum Bergman kernel. And again, that should work. We tried it for the simplest example, and it looks like it's going to work, but that's kind of work in progress. So anyway, so these are the initial condition, and then you want to prove that the recursion itself holds. And well, to prove the recursion holds, you just do exactly the same steps as you did for Hurwitz case. Turns out that for the topological vertex, or any toric geometry, there is a cut and join equation. In fact, this is how the mathematical theory of the topological vertex was computed, using this cut and join equation for the topological vertex. There is also an analog of the ELSV formula, which is basically rewriting the topological vertex in terms of Hodge integrals. And turns out that when you do that, you end up with a finite sum. So now you can expand at branch points. And now you end up with some invariants n, which you have no idea what they mean. But what you know is that the Laplace transform of that is a topological recursion. And that gives you, now it's really mirror symmetry. So now there's no quote anymore. So this is really the mirror living on the mirror curve. The cut and join here is the topological vertex. That's really the A model, the Gromov-Witten theory. And what's really interesting here is that to actually implement mirror symmetry, local mirror symmetry, you really have to go through this step of defining these invariants here, which we have no idea what they mean. But these are seem to be the fundamental invariants. They correspond to basically expanding these W's at the branch points instead of at infinity. So that's an open question, which I think is really interesting to try to interpret these objects. So let me give you a hint of what I think they should be. But I cannot prove that. So when you actually look at this Gromov-Witten theory here, so you're basically looking at maps from open Riemann surface to some target space, right, with some Lagrangian D-brain here. From a toric point of view, you can write the target space as some toric graph. Say this is the toric graph for local P2. And then your Lagrangian submanifold becomes we write it in this way. It basically ends on one of the legs of the toric graph. This is the type of Lagrangian submanifold that we're interested in. And when you're doing this expansion here, if you translate it to the A model side, what you're really doing is sending this grain really far away from the vertex. But if you're doing now the expansion, what happens is that the branch points of the curve, the mirror side, really corresponds to the vertices of your toric diagram here. You can see that just by looking at the mirror map. You just take your branch points, you map them on the other side, you end up with the vertices. So what it looks like when you expand at the branch points is that you're actually sending your grain right on the vertex. But then if it's on the vertex, it changes topology, so it's really a different enumerative problem. The grain here just becomes R3, while here it was basically R2 and just 1. So it's really a different enumerative problem. So that's kind of expected. You're going to get some completely different invariants. What I would guess is that if you could define some sort of open Gromovian invariants where you're actually mapping to this Lagrangian brain, probably then you would end up with this end here. But, well, such a theory has never been defined, as far as I can tell, neither mathematically nor physically, so I don't know if that's true. But really, just from the mirror map, it looks really like you're kind of localizing in the vertices here, which seems to be what's going on. So I think that would be really interesting to try to define these things and compute these things explicitly. Okay, so I guess I'm going to end with maybe just a few comments. I started at 3:15, right? That's all good. So I'm going to end with a few comments on how this can be generalized, because there's one way which I think is going to be really interesting to generalize, which we're actually working on right now. Well, one way which can be done is just to look at different target space. So here I've only looked at toric LBO threefolds, but in fact, well, it's pretty clear that it should work for more general. Well, not for like compact LBO or things like that, but for example, so when you define the moduli space of curves, you're really looking at maps to a point, but you can look at points mapped out by some group, which is an orbifold of a point, and then in principle you could do exactly the same thing. And what would be really interesting to look at here is how the finite group here, or whatever group, is encoded in the spectral curve. You should end up with some spectral curve. Maybe it's going to have more than simple ramification points, maybe with some monodromy, which is going to be corresponding to that. I don't know, but probably is going to be a spectral curve in this case that could be worked out. There's the same thing. So Hurwitz number were mapped to P1. Again, you can map out by some groups, have some sort of orbicurve, and then you can do probably a similar thing. Just needs to be worked out, but that would be really interesting as well. But the most interesting generalization, I think, is the quantum version of all that. So I said that you could use a quantum curve and quantum Bergmann kernel to compute these things. In fact, you can define the whole recursion in a quantum version, where basically every step is just an operator acting on some function, so it's a differential operator, and then you can solve to get every step of the recursion. This corresponds in matrix model to considering some kind of weird matrix model that are called beta ensembles. So it's a type of matrix models, but you can really define all these steps explicitly. And on the A model, there's also something which is defined, which is an extension of the topological vertex, which is a refined topological vertex, where basically instead of having one coupling constant, you have two coupling constants. Reason why people are interested in that is to make contact with the Enstanton counting and the Nikrasov's partition functions and all that kind of stuff. But it turns out that it's pretty clear that this refined vertex is exactly mirror symmetric to the quantum version of the recursion. At least it works for the simplest, for the disk and the annulus, but it's not clear it's going to work in general, but it's pretty obvious it should. The only problem is that it's really hard to do any calculations because you actually have differential operators at every step, and you really need to solve differential equations. So it's very hard to do calculations to compare with the refined topological vertex. But if this is true, then there's plenty of applications to Enstanton counting and all that stuff, which would be very interesting. But this is kind of work in progress. So I don't know how that's going to go. But that's what I wanted to say. So thank you very much. When the target here is in a... So you want to look at like kind of stable maps to elliptic curve? Hasn't been studied, I don't know. From the recursion point of view, I guess... Yeah. You mean for the target space being a Riemann? Yeah. In fact, even for local curves, you could do, you can basically know it. But no, it is known for. Well, you have this. Right. Yeah, no, it would be interesting to see whether that kind of structure is there. I would think probably, but I don't know.
Is that flow string or open string? And all history is open.
Yeah, but if you have descendants, I think you can. Harvest number for the target regions. Yeah, for harvest case, I mean, you're not really talking about open anymore. You're talking about ramification. It's got a kind of different interpretation, but maybe that's. I don't know. I mean, that's a, clearly an interesting question, but. The properties.
What are they indexed by?
Well, okay, they're going to be indexed. So they come from expanding this thing. So actually, if you want to do the expansion explicitly, you're going to have n's defined for each branch point. So you're going to have a sum over, because you're expanding at the branch points. So in general, you're going to have more than one. So you're going to have n's for each branch points. In fact, you're going to have an expansion. So I guess. N, where the I here is basically corresponding to the branch points, you can mix them. You're basically expanding, I mean, you have each variable, you can expand at each branch point, and you get some pretty complicated expansion. So they're going to be indexed, and the k's here correspond to, the power of the expansion in your variables. So you have some variables here which were defined near the branch points, right? Something like, something like that. These were the good variables near the branch points.
And what kind of numbers are the n's?
The n's? N is the number of variables in here.
No, the n, the invariant. Is it like a rational number?
For which case? For the toric case, there are actually going to be functions of the Kähler parameters. There are going to be some generating functions of something. I haven't computed them explicitly, so I don't know what the. I mean, all these things here, I mean, remember, this is just expansion in the open string parameter, if you wish. You also have the closed string parameter in there. But, if you expand them, yeah, I have no idea what they. That's a good question. I mean, for the vertex, it's probably feasible to actually look at them very explicitly. But, yeah.
All right. Let's thank you.